Hi, this is Anne.
And this is Sarah. And in this episode, AADL talks to Ruth Ozeki. We discuss Ruth's novel, A Tale for the Time Being, which is the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti Reads selection for 2015. So, Ruth Ozeki, your novel, A Tale for the Time Being, was selected as Ann Arbor Ipsy Reads Community Read Book for this year. And if there are some listeners out there who haven't read your book yet, could you give us a little synopsis of what you feel the book is about?
Okay. Boy, you know, it's one of those books that's kind of complicated to describe. However, actually, at its heart, it's a pretty simple story. It's a story about a young Japanese schoolgirl named Nao Yasutani, who is living in Tokyo, and she's writing a diary. Okay. But it's an unusual diary because she's writing it with the intent of leaving it somewhere for someone to find. Right. So in other words, she's writing it for someone, but she doesn't know who that person is. Okay. And it's a story told in two parts. It's her story. She's this young girl, and she's living in Tokyo. She's being pretty badly bullied in school. And so in a way, this diary is her lifeline. Right. And in fact, she's decided that she's going to commit suicide. But before she does commit suicide, she wants to do one last act of redemption, which is to tell the fascinating life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, who's a Zen Buddhist nun. Okay. So this is what she sets out to do in the pages of her diary. Meanwhile, the second half of the story is told by the woman who finds her diary, who's a woman who lives on the Pacific Northwest coast of Canada, who is a writer, a novelist, a blocked novelist, who's walking along the beach one day and discovers this Hello Kitty lunchbox that's washed up on the beach, and she takes it home, assuming that it's part of the detritus or the debris from the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. She brings the diary home, or she brings the lunchbox home and unpacks it, and inside discovers the diary that's been written by Nao Yasutani. And she becomes, she starts to read it, of course, and she becomes obsessed with it and is determined to discover the fate of this young girl.
As the community reads book, what is one talking point or takeaway from the book that you would like to see the community talk about as a group?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, the story is about the sort of mysterious almost connections between between these two people, between the young girl and this woman who discovers a diary, but in a larger context, it's really about the interconnectedness of all things in the world. So in this case, the two characters are connected by the sort of the great oceanic gyres in the Pacific Ocean that bring us together, really, that connect us. And I think that, at its heart, the book is about that. And in particular, it's about the way that books bring us together, right? The way that reading and writing brings us together. And so I always imagine it as if there's this kind of, they're the great geological gyres, oceanic gyres, but there's also a kind of these cultural or informational gyres that connect us as well. And literature, art, these are, in a way, form the connective tissues or are part of this, this gyre of human culture.
You are doing a good job of boiling down what is such a huge and interwoven and complex story, and then that's what it's about.
That's what it's about. That's kind of what it's about. Well, it's also about other things. It's about, quantum many worlds interpretation, and it's about, it's about World War II and about kamikaze pilots, and it's about, it goes on and on and on. But all of that is, it's when you're looking at it sort of on a bigger scale, it's about, the gyres of time, the gyres of space, all of these ways that we're connected through these.
I think it's just so brilliant. By being an example of what it is and what you're supposed to talk about, it's just, it's great to, I feel like the more I look at it, the the better example it is of what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
If
yeah,
that
yeah,
makes
yeah.
sense.
And it's also just a story. You know, it's a story about yeah. these two people, you know.
So it works on a couple, like, how deep do you want to go?
That's right. That's right.
When Anne and I sat down and were talking about it and, you know, starting to talk about questions we wanted to ask you, we had said, how do you pronounce the teenage girl's name? Is it Now? Oh, Now, a time being.
Oh, now.
Oh, I get it. Because reading it, I hadn't said it aloud. We hadn't thought, you know, I hadn't been narrating it to myself. Okay. And but I just kept finding, like, it's like an Easter egg, you know, little things that are, it's a joke. It's a
That's
reference
right.
all throughout.
That's right.
So how do you formulate that? Are you, like, do you have a map? Do you have one of those serial killer bulletin boards where you're connecting everything
yes.
as you work?
Yes. I use whatever mapping tools I can, you know, come up with, and usually I have many, many different mapping tools. You're right. The you know, there are many levels that the book works on, right? And so, in order to keep all of those levels straight, you know, I rely on all sorts of means to do that. One of the things that I will certainly use big bulletin boards with index cards and post-its and lines and various things, you know, kind of connecting all of the bits and pieces. But I also use Excel spreadsheets, and, you know, I have various mind mapping tools, software and stuff like that I also use. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll you know, find a big room with a long, long conference table and actually just spread the manuscript out, right, all over the conference table so that I can, you know, especially around the edges, so that I can then walk around the conference table, right, and literally pace and walk through the book, right? And at some point, you know, when a book becomes very long and very complicated, I can't spread it out page by page, but I can spread it out sort of section by section or chapter by chapter. And so then I can kind of walk my way around and get a physical sense of, you know, the way the book is unfolding through time, right? So it really is, it's creating a kind of a spatial dimension to the book. And I find that to be really, really helpful. Of course, it's hard to find a, you know, enormously large conference table, you know, in that I can use in New York City, but, you know, but I do my best. Yeah.
I was wondering how you interwove the stories of Now and Ruth. Did you write Now's part first and then add Ruth in, or was it always planned that you were going to have these two characters balancing each other out?
Well, the two characters take turns, right? So the two voices are interleaved, right? In other words, they alternate. So Now starts, then Ruth, then Now, then Ruth, then Now, then Ruth, and it continues like that throughout the book. I started writing the book in 2006, and Now's voice was the first one that came to me, and she kind of announced herself to me. She literally, the first words in the book, "Hi, my name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you." Right? And so she kind of announced herself to me like this, and I wrote that down and waited. And then little by little, you know, her story began to emerge. And it became very clear that she was writing in a diary, you know, and that she was writing to somebody. In other words, it wasn't an ordinary diary. She had a sense of a reader. Right, that there was a reader out there who would find her diary and pick it up and read it. And when that happened, something magical would happen, right? The problem was that Now didn't know who her reader was, and so neither did I. Okay. So then it's my job at that point as a novelist to try to figure out, you know, who is Now writing to. And this process took an incredibly long time, okay? And it was a bit like auditioning a character for a play, right, or for a movie. I would think of a potential reader, and I would invite that reader kind of into the fictional world, and I would arrange for the reader to discover the diary somehow. Many times that happened in a library. and the reader would find the diary and start to read it and start to become engaged with Now's story and with, you know, with all of the things that Now was saying, her problems and her travails. And then the reader would start to react, right? And so then there would, you know, a back and forth would start to happen, right? And meanwhile, Now's story is growing, partly in reaction to what the reader's doing, right? There's a kind of an influence there going back and forth. And so the fictional world would start to grow, and it would get, you know, kind of all plump and juicy and, you know, just the way a world should get, right? Until, you know, one morning I'd wake up about 50 or 100 pages in and open the manuscript and discover that the world had just gone flat overnight, right? I would never be able to quite understand why, but I would realize, okay, this is the wrong reader, right? So then I would usher that reader out of the book, right?
Good try.
Yeah. And, you know, after a suitable period of heartbreak and grief and mourning, you know, and disappointment, I would think of another reader, a new reader, right? And I would do the same thing, invite this new reader in, arrange for the new reader to find the book. The new reader would start to read it, start to get engaged, start to react. You know, the world would grow a little bit bigger, right? And then the same thing would happen. You know, I'd wake up one morning and the world had gone flat. And so this happened four or five times, right, between 2006 and the beginning of 2011. Finally, at the beginning of 2011, I managed to finish an entire draft of the book. It was completely different than the book that has been published, right? The book that's here now. It was very, very different. It was, you know, it was kind of a lighthearted romp through a library, actually, right?
You still have that draft? I'm interested in this draft.
I do have the draft. I promise you, it is not good. You would not like it. Would not like it. It is not a very good draft. The character of the reader is not very interesting. You know, anyway. The point is that I did finish it, and I didn't know how to fix it. I knew there were problems. I didn't know how to fix them. So I was I'd submitted it to my agent, and she agreed that there were problems, but we decided that we'd go ahead and give it to my editor, and maybe my editor would, you know, help me out. And so I was just getting ready to do that in March of 2011 when the Japanese earthquake and tsunami and meltdown at Fukushima happened, right, on March 11th. And this was a, you know, this was a huge, huge, devastating moment, right? I have family and friends in Tokyo and also in Sendai, where the earthquake, near the earthquake's epicenter. And so for the first week or so, you know, it was just chaos trying to figure out, you know, how everyone was and if everybody was okay. And thank goodness they were, at least my friends were. And then, you know, and I just remember, and you probably remember this too, but during that, you know, that first couple of weeks, just watching those images of, you know, the tsunami, you know, just washing away entire towns and villages, you know, just literally just washing them out to sea. And I just couldn't stop watching these images. You know, it just seemed so horrible to me to watch this thing happening. And then, you know, the nuclear plant started to, you know, explode and melt down. So it was a really disturbing time. And somewhere in there, I suddenly realized that, you know, that there are these events in history that are so catastrophic that they almost stop time, you know, or they divide time. They create a kind of rift in time. And suddenly time is divided into, you know, pre- and post, right? 9/11 was like this for us, I think, here, right? You know, and in this case, you know, it occurred to me that I had written a, you know, pre-earthquake, pre-tsunami, pre-Fukushima book, and now we were living in a post-earthquake, post-tsunami, post-Fukushima world, and the book that I had written was absolutely irrelevant. It was no longer viable, right? So this was a shock, but I, you know, withdrew the manuscript. And at that point, I pretty much, you know, was thinking that that was it. I didn't see any way forward. But the girl's voice, Now's voice, just wouldn't leave me alone, you know. And so then, you know, after sitting with it for a while, I guess I was talking with my husband, too. And he pointed out something very interesting, which was that, you know, the reality of the earthquake and the tsunami and the meltdown at Fukushima was, you know, had broken the world, right? It had really just broken the world. And it had, you know, it had broken my fictional world too, the fictional world of the book. And so that the only way then to, respond to that was to acknowledge the brokenness and to allow the brokenness to be, right? And so one way to do that would be to step into the fictional world myself, you know, as a real human being, right? And to step into the fictional world and to allow the fictional world to stay broken, right? In other words, to kind of interpenetrate with reality, right? And it would also allow me, you know, as a character in the fictional world, to comment on and, you know, try to process the events of, you know, of 3/11. And so I thought this was a really, you know, exactly the right way to move forward with it. And so, you know, I did, and I thanked him, and I, you know, I said, Oliver, that's a great idea, but, you know, of course you do realize that if I'm in the book, then you have to be in the book too. And so, you know, luckily
that's how Ruth
he
ended
agreed.
Up being the reader.
That's right, and that's how that's Ruth so ended great. Up being the reader. So this is a very long answer to your question, but, you know, so then in the next... So I basically took the manuscript and unzipped it, right? And threw away the half that I never liked to begin with anyway. And I was left with about, you know, maybe a third of the original manuscript, which was Now's diary. And then I just started again, creating the Ruth scenes, you know, that would interleave with Now's diary. And Now's, of course, that also changed what happened to Now?
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah. So it certainly did change the outcome. It changed. You know, I ended up rewriting the ending completely. So what I, you know, that when this started to happen, I had the general sense of Now's story, right? But when Ruth took over as the reader of the book, you know, of course she ended up, you know, sort of changing the outcome as well. So. It was a long and very grueling process.
I was going to ask you how I the voice of Now, the character of Now, she's so compelling. She's so great. She's so real. And in fact, in hearing you describe that and the voice of Now wouldn't leave you alone, my instinct on that was to say, good for her. And then I was like, wait, no, she's not real.
Yeah, I know, I know.
That's still just in your head. So I was going to ask you if it was hard to write because I find her so compelling and her voice is so true, if it was hard for you to get in that space, but it sounds like it was not really your choice.
Now is one of these characters who just is there. You know, I sometimes, you know, and this is a little fanciful, but sometimes I do think that there are characters sort of up there in the ether somewhere, you know, sort of swimming around in this kind of primordial, you know, Pirandellian soup, you know, and they're, you know, they're kind of looking down. Do you ever watch those? Did you ever watch those wonderful old movies where the gods on Olympus used to look down through the clouds and see all of the mortals like Jason and the Argonauts and stuff?
Sure.
You know, see all of the mortals
Move
walking
around.
Right. That's kind of what I feel like the characters are, that they're up there, kind of like the gods in Olympus, and they're looking down through the ether, you know, and they're looking for, you know, like, oh, there's a novelist. You know, let's use her, right? And they, whoosh, you know, swoop down and, you know, and sort of take up residence in your mind and sort of parasitize your brain for the duration that it takes for their story to get told.
And steer you into the Hello Kitty
exactly,
lunchbox.
Right.
Oh, this is compelling. I could use this.
Exactly. That's what I need.
And they're just like stroking their beard. Yes,
that's right.
I knew.
That's right. So I felt like, you know, Now is one of those characters. She was just, you know, she I think that she was just out there and... You know, I happened along at the right moment, and she was like, oh, there goes one.
Yeah.
You know? And then that's it, 5 years of my life, you know, at her service.
So writing yourself into the book, did you put a lot of autobiographical aspects into the book?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I would look at the Ruth section of the book as being, you know, it's definitely autobiographical, but it's also fictional. It's both. You know, there's, you know, starting with the fact that I didn't actually discover a Hello Kitty lunchbox washed up on the beach, right? But, you know, the voice of this girl did come into my mind. You know, I did discover her diary, right? So in a sense, the you know, lunchbox washing up on the beach is almost a kind of an allegorical or you know, metaphorical, you know, analog to what you know, what actually did happen. But having said that, there, you know, the idea of the Ruth character is autobiographical and you know, Ruth in the book has a husband named Oliver. You know, I also have a husband named Oliver. You know, we both have cats. You know, they're various
so
things.
Is Pesto a real cat?
Well, okay. So I made a rule early on, which was that if I was going to use anybody's name, I would ask permission, right? And so, you know, and there are very, you know, there are various people in the book whose actual names I did use. But when I asked the cat, my cat, permission to use his name, he sort of turned his back on me and started licking his asshole. And I took that as a no. So I changed his name in order to protect him.
That's very respectful. I of had you, to not of the cat.
Well, you know, one must respect one's cat after all. Otherwise, all hell will break loose.
I like very much that your husband gave you permission to fictionalize his life.
Yes.
And your cat
yeah.
did not.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, he was great. He was a real sport about it. He said that he thought it would be an interesting thought experiment.
So I thought it was brilliant the way that you did bounce between now and you and Ruth, your voice in that book, and then the way that you would do internet searches in the book for now. Because I reading it, had I not had both parts, if I would have just been reading Now's diary, I would have totally been trying to search the internet. Okay, it's on YouTube. Where is this? Is this a real thing? Yeah. And then just the fact that you were searching in real time, the tsunami was something that was in my mind too, mm-hmm. from being on the news, and it just made it so much more real to me than had it just been mm-hmm. Now's diary. So I thought that was fantastic.
Thank you. At one point it did occur to me, perhaps it should just be Now's diary. Perhaps that's you know, what should be there, and that's it. But I always wanted it to be about the relationship. You know, I wanted it to be about the relationship that comes to pass when, you know, the right book falls into the right reader's hands, you know, and that the way that as readers we throw ourselves into the fictional world, you know. And so that was, in a way, it's a love story, you know, it's a love story about writers and readers, right? And so, you know, to tell only one side of that story didn't seem like enough.
Yeah, another question I had, the concept of time and quantum mechanics and different philosophies is brought up throughout the book. The Zen master Dogen, mm-hmm. the idea of breaking down moments into, was it a snap of the fingers? Was it 65?
65. It depends on who you ask.
Okay.
It's either 65 or 64.
Okay.
Yeah. Moments, right?
But yeah, so, just to yeah. make something that's already so quick, break that down further yeah. at the atomic level. That was very fascinating to me.
Fascinating, right? And especially since Dogen lived, you know, in 1250, you know. He died in 1253, I think. So, you know, it's such a modern seeming concept to divide time down into nanoseconds. But in fact, these are, you know, ancient teachings that have been around forever. Yeah.
Yeah. So did this idea, was it there from the start when you started writing Now's part, or did this come in further from as you were exploring the other characters that would be the reader for Now?
No, the philosophical underpinnings of the book, I think, were there right from the start. I knew that I wanted to, and in fact, one of the inspirations, I think, for Now's voice was the Dogen text that I had been studying earlier in I think, 2002 or 2003 or something like that. And I had stumbled across this. I'd been reading Dogen for quite a while, but I was reading this one fascicle or essay called Uji, which the character U is the character for being, right, or existence, and the character Ji is the character for time. So it can either, you know, be translated as being time or existence time, but very often it's flipped, so then it would be time being, or for the time being, and there are many different translations of it, of this fascicle, but the one that I was reading used the translation for the time being, right? And this phrase, for the time being, is repeated, you know, throughout the book. And I think it's an interesting phrase because depending on how you inflect it, it can mean different things, right? So if you say, for the time being, it means for now, right? If you say for the time being, it means it seems to imply a kind of being, like a human being or an alien being or, you know, an entity made out of time, right? And so this phrase, I think probably because of the instability, right, every time I ran across it, I'd kind of stumble across it, you know, stumble on it. And I think it just kind of, you know, once again, just sort of took up residence in my mind and then came out in the voice of now, right? So once again, you know, it was the Dogen philosophy and this includes his theorizing about time, right? His teaching about time. All of this was kind of there in the book right from the start, as well as, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the Heideggerian, you know, essays as well on the nature of time and being. And then, you know, there were other, I think, you know, there were various other kinds of, well, Proust, the idea of, you know, in search of lost time was something that I knew I wanted to play with. So all of these things were kind of there and you know, found their way into the book in different ways.
I absolutely love that about the book. It was really fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
Be made to think twice about something you're reading, because usually a phrase, you'll just go quickly over it and not think twice about it, but you really had to slow down and be in the moment when you were reading as well to,
yeah,
to
that
think
was,
about those.
That was interesting. You know, Ruth, when she's reading Now's diary, is starting to experience time in different ways, right? And so at one point, I think she decides that she is going to read at the same rate that Now would have written at. Right, so she wasn't going to read fast. In other words, she wasn't just going to read through to the end of, you know, to the end of the diary. She was going to, you know, intentionally slow herself down and read only as much as Now might have written in that day. Right, and so many readers have come up to me afterwards and said that they ended up doing the exact same thing. That they ended up, you know, intentionally slowing themselves down, and that they'd never done this with a, you know, they'd never had this experience, you know, with a book before. But I thought that was really wonderful. That really made me happy.
Yeah. You know, that you hear so much more often that I stayed up all night to finish.
Yes,
and it's like the race to the end. And I do think that your book was probably best savored over a long period.
Yeah,
There's so much happening that to really digest it, you don't really know what has really happened unless you slowed down.
Yeah.
I think a fast read would really allow a lot to go over your head, or make it just a very simple.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think the book can certainly be read as a simple story. I mean, you know, that's the first level that I think it's operating at. But, you know, I think, and that this is the other thing people are telling me, is that, you know, I meet a lot of readers who go back and read it a second and a third time, because there is, you know, there's more there that can be unpacked, you know, as you read it. There's all sorts. You use the word Easter egg hunt, and there's lots of little Easter eggs, you know.
So, speaking of reading, do you have any favorite authors that you go to?
Gosh.
Or is there anyone you're really passionate
right
about?
Right now, I just happen to be going through, I'm reading two authors who I just love. I'm always passionate about whoever I'm reading at the moment.
That's lovely.
And yeah, so, you know, and I'm deep in a David Mitchell phase right now.
Oh.
I hadn't read The Thousand Autumns of Jakob de Zoet before. And so I just finished that, and now I'm on The Bone Clocks.
Oh, great.
And I'm loving it. Another writer who I just very recently discovered is Claire Vane Watkins.
Okay.
She wrote a wonderful book, collection of short stories called Battleborn.
Okay.
And she has a new novel coming out in May of this year. And this is of relevance to your community. She's going to be teaching. She's coming to University of Michigan to start teaching in September. And she is a wonderful writer. I just did a Penn Faulkner reading and conversation, staged conversation with her in Washington, D.C. Last night? No, two nights ago. And she's just a really, really, really wonderful writer. So, it's wonderful that she's going to be right here in Ann Arbor.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the recommendation.
Yes,
we'll have
yes.
To check
no,
out.
You really must. Battleborn is amazing.
Yeah. Speaking of teaching at universities, you're making my segues so easy. I saw on your website that you'll be starting to teach creative writing at Smith College.
That's right.
And I read further on your website that you are a graduate. of Smith College.
Right. That's right.
So
that's
are you time traveling a little bit?
Good point. Yes.
Are you going to feel a little like I've been here before?
That's the point. I think the point is, you know, I had a wonderful time at Smith, and I, it's really where I fell in love with, you know, with sort of the intellectual life. You know, I fell in love with writing. I fell in love with reading. I fell in love with, you know, you know, libraries with, you know, well, that's not true. I fell in love with libraries long before. But in any case, you know, I really got engaged with academics at Smith, and also with creative work as well. And so my hope is that by going back to that campus, it'll trigger a kind of Pavlovian response, you know, and I'll step back on campus and immediately, right, just sort of find the nearest desk and sit down and start working. That's my hope. We'll see.
Well, I hope so, too, because we're interested to read more.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, the other thing, too, is just I remember, you know, one of the things about Smith that was so wonderful is that I just remember, you know, I remember being a student there, and the position I'm taking there is called the Drew Professorship, and it's a 2 to 3 year position that's occupied by a professional writer. And I remember how, you know, how important it was to have, you know, just to know that there were, you know, real writers on campus, you know, and Richard Wilbur, the poet, was there when I was there. And I never took a class from him because he was a poet and I was writing prose and, you know, but just knowing that, you know, that there was a real writer on campus was exciting to everybody.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to it.
To learn more about Ruth Ozeki, visit ozekiland.com. AADL Talks to Ruth Ozeki is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.